we just start by taking the first 5 minutes for any reflections or comments about yesterday or the day before or whatever. And we had a question being held from yesterday that we didn't get to. And Dave, do you want to say it again?
Yeah, I think we left the point there where I was wondering, as a parish pastor, you were talking about establishing our clergy's office in the doctor's clinic to relate to a patient in the early stages, for example, 10 years. What would have happened if you'd been there 10 years before? My question was, is it possible, or how would it be possible for a parish pastor like myself, to establish some kind of a liaison with the local doctors and clinics in my area so that I could have that same opportunity that you referred to?
Well, let me just take you as the illustration. Do you have any doctors that you feel good about that have ever worked with you before?
Yes.
One or two? Three?
Two or three, yes.
Would you ever consider having a breakfast, a series of, say, make a contract with them that you would have breakfast with them for four Monday mornings at 6:30 before they make rounds at the hospital, where you would be willing, you would like to present to them four cases, four parishioners' problems, or if they're not parishioners, somebody that you've been working with, that you would like to know how they would go about working with you on this project. Would that make any sense? Would they be willing to do that?
I think so, because the ones I'm thinking of are members of the parish or personal friends, and I think they would be certainly open to that.
All right. So then, suppose that now, in your community, do you have another pastor or two who would help you with this or do it? Would like to do it alongside you, and you'd have three pastors there and three doctors, so that you'd have, six people for breakfast who would contract to be together for four Monday mornings, or five or six. Is that a possibility? What denomination are these other pastors? You think of?
One is Catholic, and the others that I'm most familiar with are Lutherans and members of our local church.
Okay. So, each of them could probably think of a doctor or so that would be willing to do it. I wouldn't want this to get too big, but I think the only way to develop a relationship with doctors is to use the method that they feel most comfortable using, namely the case study method. And you would then have to come with a short, but well, carefully designed or carefully written statement of the problem. One page, single space maybe, two pages at the most. And you would there, in that presentation, you would give a quick background of where you knew this person from or in what connection. Ask a doctor who is, hopefully, that you'll be presenting cases that will be patients of one of these doctors. So in that case, you would do it jointly. You would ask him then, at that point, to present the medical problem. And then you would have, as the main part of your paper, the spiritual potential for, or the potential for spiritual care, for pastoral care. Roger?
Do you have to go through any legal legal to have the doctor expose the case history to you as a pastor?
All right. If you have any question about that, then do not label the patient with any names. Of course, you never do that on any write-up, just in case you drop it someplace. I would think that it wouldn't be, that you would not need to identify the patient to that extent. And if any of the doctors are really concerned about it, make up a case that's like that, but not exactly the same. Then you're safe. That might be the best. Or go to one of the textbooks now, by Kleinbell, perhaps, and see if one of his cases would fit. In other words, use a case. It happens that it works best, I have found, if you have an actual case that you're working with now, and you're working with the doctor, and you get some other input as well. But maybe the doctors would be a little bit threatened by having to present this in the presence of their colleagues when it has to do with the spiritual dimension. And what we found in our religion medicine case conferences at the University of Chicago was that after we had presented the case in the first 15 minutes, it was much easier to talk about the physical and even mental aspects of the patient's problem than it was to talk about the spiritual. We have great difficulty yet with the vocabulary. Doctors and ministers, well, ministers don't use this vocabulary very easily in case presentations yet. And we have to learn how to do that. So just know that it's not going to be easy, but it'll be instructive. And my guess is that if you have 3 to 6 doctors there, and you have, well, let's make it even if you want to, 3 doctors and 3 ministers. That what those doctors are going to be doing as you're presenting, each of you presenting your cases, is to try to sense how he could use you in the future for a patient that he's thinking of right now, that may, this may not be his patient. And one of the doctors will decide that you are the one he'd like to work most closely with, and not the other 2 ministers. He doesn't feel comfortable with them. And another doctor may not look at you and as much as he would at another pastor and say, gee, that fellow is more like me. I think I'd feel more comfortable with him. And from then on, you'll find that as you make it a point to be where they are at certain times, such as breakfast and so on, and in the hospital, that they'll stop you in the hall and say, hey, would you see a patient? Would you come with me right now and come in and see this patient with me? And then you're off and running. Does that kind of speak to your question?
Yes.
Yes?
Can I just ask you 2 questions that you might want to briefly comment on? The difference, if any, between holistic health and psychosomatic health. And then the second one, if rather hard saying that some people have, that all illness is a result of sin.
You want me to just answer that in about a minute and a half? We have a whole course on that. No, that's a big one, and I won't even try much except to say that it's a very important question. But I can say a word about holistic and psychosomatic. The psychosomatic movement didn't take off quite the way they thought it would. There are 2 or 3 journals in the field of psychosomatic medicine. The trouble with psychosomatic is that the word psych, which we know from the Greek, really is psyche. And the psyche's first meaning is soul. Mm-hmm. Its second meaning is spirit. Its third meaning is mind. It never means brain. So when the psychiatrists, psyche, psyche, iatros, remember yesterday we talked about iatrogenic illness. Iatros means healer, iatrogenic, G-E-N means the causes of, or the beginnings of, like Genesis, caused by the doctor, as Dr. Harms described it. So you have psychosomatic, where the psychiatrists have taken, in a sense, a spiritual word and made it mean mind, first of all, in their thinking. So that a psychosomatic problem is usually a mind-body problem. But if you take the word more seriously as spirit, then it is a spirit-body problem. But if you read the journals in psychosomatic medicine, you'll find that they really are not into spiritual interests. This was before the days of holistic medicine. Psychosomatic goes back 40 years almost. It was started by a psychiatrist who was also an ordained minister, and she had some great ideas about it, but they were lost in the shuffle, and it was taken over by psychiatry. So psychosomatic medicine, while yes, we in the Lutheran General Hospital, we have a psychosomatic ward, it's not what we're talking about, really.
Would you say that quite frequently people will say, well, his mind is going, if that is not correct, it's really the brain that's going, the mind being of the soul?
error in difficulties with the semantics. I wouldn't know quite how to answer that. All right, now today what I'd like to do is to say, is to describe what I see to be the situation of healthcare in America. And the basic question, of course, that I'm constantly addressing here is, why should the church be interested in healthcare? The first day, I tried to make it as clear as I could that the church already is involved in healthcare, but doesn't realize it. And for some of you who weren't here, I read a long list of things that many churches are involved in, like Meals on Wheels, like FISH, which is a group of people who help other people, like all the social activities in the church, which are very health-giving, if you don't drink too much coffee, and so on. And I'm convinced that the church ought to be in the health field with both feet. In a sense, it has been related to health through its hospitals, which just grew out of a natural need to help people. Augustana Hospital, where I became chaplain, first of all, for 8 years, it happened that the cholera epidemic was going on in Chicago. And the people were just getting sicker and sicker and dying like flies. And the pastor of Emmanuel Lutheran Church in Chicago had a huge parsonage, he and his wife, and they took in some of these people who were very sick because they had no place to go and there were no hospitals except a county hospital where you went to die. Nobody got well if you went to one of the county hospitals. And because they were just pest houses where you got sicker because of the cross, whatever. So doctors began to come into the parsonage then and to make that into a temporary hospital. But when the cholera epidemic was over, the doctors were so accustomed to going into the parsonage and helping, and the pastor's wife was the cook, and the pastor was the chaplain for this new hospital, that the doctors were saying, well, now the cholera epidemic is over, but I have another patient that really needs some help. Would you mind if I brought this patient in? And the pastor's wife said, well, okay, if it's just a few days. Then another doctor would say, well, I've got a patient, I've got to amputate a leg. Would it be all right if I used your dining room table? And that's how the hospital started. And finally, the pastor and his wife moved out. And so,
when was that, Granger?
About 1885, something like that. In fact, Augustana has its 100th anniversary this year, so it'll be 1884. And that's the way many hospitals started. They just so they built a new soon there was no connection. And I'm just terribly sorry that the churches didn't all decide to have a little hospital alongside so that we could see that the church and the hospital are naturally grafted together.
How about the graveyard?
And the graveyard is on the other side. I wouldn't put that too close to the hospital.
There's still a lot of churches that have the graveyard.
And that's the symbol of many churches, that they take care of you at the end of life. Now, first we have to ask, why generally do people get sick? And I think of five words that help me to understand this, and you may have many more, but just to get it started, and then that will move into where what the present health system is like. When I first became a chaplain, the word that became clear to me very quickly, as I was looking at my notes at the end of each day, my cards that I had written on my calling on certain people, was the word loss. All kinds of patients were telling me about something they had lost. Here was a patient who, a man who had been working for a corporation for a number of years and was suddenly fired. And now he was a patient in the hospital. Here was a patient down the hall from him who had been working at this concern for a number of years, was hoping to become the manager of his department when the manager retired. And so he worked doubly hard to get ready for this, and it was just generally assumed that he would get it. But when the manager retired, the boss brought in his nephew. And now this man was sick. Or on another floor was a lady who was in her late 30s, who was from Muscatine, Iowa, whose husband, she and her husband had lived in Muscatine for all their lives, 30-some years, and they had a nice house near the downtown area where he worked. He could walk to work and walk home for lunch every day. They had a garden together, and life was quiet and lovely. And then one day he was seen by somebody in his field as having great potential, and he was offered a big job in Chicago at, I think it was 3 times the salary. And so they got a lovely apartment looking over the lake, and they had parties for them in Muscatine, and everybody congratulated them, and they were excited by it. And then they moved in, and it was great for the first month or so, and then it was clear that he no longer came home for lunch, but he also didn't come home on Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays, because they now put him out on the road. And she was left with this beautiful apartment until soon she hated everything in it, because she had lost everything that was important to her in her whole life. It was as if all her friends had died. She was now going through deep grief. And so that was the second word related, of course, to loss, that I began to see as absolutely essential to understanding the causes of illness. And I began to feel that perhaps one third of all the patients I was seeing in the hospital were there in close relationship to some losses which they had experienced, loss or several losses, and that they were now grieving. And in the grief syndrome, which we'll discuss tomorrow, there is always physical, there are always physical symptoms. And so one day after I'd been there about a year, I asked the doctors if I could present a paper on this to the medical staff. And they said no, because I wasn't a doctor. And it was a scientific lecture, and they had to have people who were approved for scientific lectures, because they get brownie points for going to those lectures. And then I talked to the staff people and who were on the committee, and finally they said, well, if you just will take 10 minutes. So I presented for 10 minutes this great idea that I had, that one out of every 3 patients in our hospital was there in close relationship to some loss which they had experienced. And I knew they would be excited by this new insight. They were not. But I read this paper some month or two later at another hospital out of town, and when you're out of town, you become an expert. So this was to the medical staff and the nursing staff of that hospital. The nurses came up to me afterwards and said, we're interested in what you've been saying. We're about to do a questionnaire on many things. Would it be all right if we slipped in a few questions on grief and loss, and we'll tell you what the results are? And so, of course, I was glad they were going to do it, and they reported back later, and they said that they interviewed some, I think, 300 or 400 new patients done by senior nurses in a long one-to-one interview, in which they asked these several questions. And they came up with a clear 38% who were able to easily articulate a series of or some overwhelming loss which they had in the previous 6 months to 6 to 12 months. Now that has still not been proven to be true, and that was many years ago. But generally we operate on the idea that a large percentage of people who get sick in relation to having lost something significant to them. A job, a friend, whatever. Then in the 50s, I became aware of a whole new area, which was an old area, but it now had the old name brought up to date under the title of stress. And this was done primarily by a man called Hans Selye, S-E-L-I-E, Hans. And Hans Selye was Canadian. I thought you'd like to hear that, Fred. That's right, one time.
You know, that's exactly the thing my doctor told me to be.
Is that so? He was not a Norwegian, though. Sorry about that. He came from Austria. Yeah. And he wrote the basic book called The Stress of Life. First, the basic book is that thick, and then he condensed it for late reading, and in the 50s it became very well known. But it's hard for us to understand today that the word stress was not used, apparently, that much in medical circles. It was more in engineering circles, the stress of bridges and so on. And it was said that, after all, you can't measure it, you can't predict it, and so on. And he set about to show that you could measure it, that you could predict it, and that you could see certain physiological changes as a result of it. Then about 7 or 8 years ago, my wife was reading a medical journal called Family Circle Magazine. And she came across this article on life changes. It had other names for it, but that's essentially what it meant. And it was, you've all read it because it's been in every magazine since. A list of 43 changes that can occur in your life. Mm-hmm. And the man who did this was Thomas Holmes of University of Washington, right here in this lovely state, and a fellow by the name of Ray. And they gave numerical value to various things that could happen to you. If you, the highest points were given for the loss of a spouse, 100 points. The loss of a child, I think, is way up there also, and other losses. But then they made the unusual discovery that good things happening to you also give you stress points, life changes, and so if you get married, you get 65 points. Divorce, you get 75 points. If you move to a lovely new home, you get something like 30 points, because whenever you move, you have to upset the equilibrium of the body, and this makes you more vulnerable to getting sick.
How about going to Holden? Is that pyramid?
I don't know how many points to get. But it would seem like a very health-giving thing to do. But he felt that he could show, and he did this with some precision, doing it also in the Orient. The first studies were done in the Occident, and as he says, there's no accident that he studied the Orient. I knew you'd appreciate that. He said that. He's a fine fellow. All right. So I began to feel that I was seeing all kinds of patients who were ill because of loss, grief, stress, life changes. But then I thought that isn't quite enough to describe why people get sick. And what began to dawn on me was that more important than these, even, had to do with the whole idea of this person's, or these people's, outlook on life. And of course, from a minister's standpoint, what I'm really talking about has to do with their faith stance. And from a philosopher's point of view, interested in their philosophy of life. From a sociologist's point of view, or people who are using new technical terms, it's now called a belief system, which I think is kind of horrible. But it's like the health industry. And that's what it's called. And that's why I think we're giving up the spiritual dimension that's got to stay in understanding healthcare, because when it becomes an industry and a doctor delivers healthcare, you really are talking about something quite different, because now you're in the field of economics, and mostly it's economics. And we're talking about cost effectiveness and all these things. And we're losing that which is truly healing, the touching of fellow men and women. Now, as I look at American healthcare, I'm impressed with the fact that it's dealing with illnesses, a large percentage of which can be put in these categories. When I ask a group of doctors, do you see this in your office very often? I can ask Roger, do you see this in your office?
Absolutely.
All right, I'm glad you said it so enthusiastically. I told him to say it. Twenty, 30 years ago when I asked this question, I'd say, well, what percentage of your patients in, you know, in general practice, let's say, would be there in relation to loss, grief, stress, life changes, and outlook on life? And they would say, oh, 50%, 40, 50%. But each decade, it seems to be going up. So that now when I ask the question, they start off with 80%. Oh, about 80% of my patients. And somebody's sure to say 90%. And then there's always somebody who says, it's 100%. That doesn't mean that was these were absolutely the causes, but that these were involved in what is now going on in this person's life. And so we're dealing with this with 100% of our patients. If it didn't happen before the illness, it now happens after they got sick. So let's just take 50%. Let's say that 50% of problems that we see in a doctor's office are related to these five concepts. Most of these illnesses come on gradually, and I find it helpful to draw a wedge here to help me to see this as kind of a slow process of getting sick. People generally with these problems take a while to get sick. Over here, let's say we're talking about people who are well. And if you wanted to, we could draw this kind of a line and say they're very well out here. Then as they lose their wellness, they become worried well, or well worried. And that is kind of the way they move into the sickness scene. Now, when we talk about illness, we realize that a lot of illness is the body's way of trying to tell us something about ourselves. And the body is very expressive. And if we don't stop to listen, it'll hurt us if it possibly can and give us pain of some kind until we do something about it. The clearest, of course, is if we're walking down a beach barefooted and we suddenly step on a tack or a nail or something and we yell, ouch! And we pick up our foot, oh man, does this hurt? And we yank out the nail and we get to some medical help soon because we've heard that that's a very dangerous area. It's the body's way of saying, you've got to stop right now and do something about this. And so when a sudden headache comes on us, maybe it's related. Maybe it's related to the fact that we are suddenly terribly disturbed by something, or a sudden backache, or a sudden stomach ache. You know how quickly that can happen when something awful is occurring in your life, how immediately you hold your stomach or you, whatever you. The body is our closest friend, and it's trying to tell us things. And we don't like pain, and so we try to cover it up with aspirin or something. And maybe we shouldn't always. All right, if the body then is trying to tell us something, let's say that it's kind of like a human drama that we're constantly watching, particularly in hospitals. But every time any patient comes into the doctor's office, I think of this patient as enacting a human drama, and I want to know what's gone into this total drama. And that's why I find that I can't work with this patient alone as a minister, and I feel that the doctor shouldn't work with the patient alone because he might or she might miss something. And I think the two of us as men usually aren't going to do the job as well as if we have a nurse there in the middle who acts as a catalyst, who has in a sense one foot in the humanities and one foot in the things of medicine, and can bring these two professions, medicine and theology, together in some kind of meaningful conversation. I mean, that's the ideal, and that's what we try to do in our holistic health centers, and it can't always be done, obviously. But I think that we should always hold an ideal up that says, do the best job you can with a holistic approach to the problem, and don't try to fragment this patient right from the beginning to deal with only one aspect of the problem. Try to see the problem in a more whole fashion. So if this is a drama, let's think of it as like a play in three acts. So let me divide this into three acts. And this is act one. And this is act two. And this is act three. Now, what should we call these acts? As I've been trying to put together an article on this general subject for a medical journal, I've asked a few medical students to help me with it so that it sounds more medical and uses medical terms, which I don't know. So they are very helpful, and the Rascals came up with three names for these acts. They suggested that we call Act 1, by the medical term, Little Bit Sick. Act 2, of course, then, is Sicker. And Act 3 is Really Sick. Now, when you or I are just a little bit sick here in the corner, who is the first person who knows it? You or I. So you or I become our own doctor in 99% of the situations that occur. 99% of the time, we make our own decisions regarding our body's reactions. And we say, what's this? Well, I've got to do something about it, or whatever. So, as a good doctor, we first of all have to make a diagnosis. And we say, why don't I feel up to par? Why am I feeling under the weather? What's wrong? And we say, well, the reason is that I've been burning the candle at both ends, and I'm just going to have to slow down. And so you now move from diagnosis to treatment, and you say, I'm going to get to bed every night at a certain time, I'm going to watch my diet, I'm going to get more exercise, I'm not going to work as hard and as long hours, or whatever you decide. And if you are correct in your diagnosis, and if you follow through on your treatment plans, instead of getting sicker, you reverse the process and you become weller. I mean, you start feeling better. So, this is what you and I do over and over again in the course of any given year. Now, suppose you don't do it. Suppose you just keep going at that pace and you don't listen to your body. You then do get sicker. And about here, members of your family begin to notice it. And often it's the wife who gets after her husband and says, George, if you don't slow down, you're going to get sick. And you know how I can always tell when you're getting close to getting sick? And he says, how can you tell? It's because you get so irritable. And he says, I am not irritable. So they get into that discussion for quite a while. But the family often acts as our doctor. And if we listen to our family members, who are concerned about us and love us, we are able to reverse the process and we get well again. If we don't listen to them, we get sicker. And about the end of Act 1 over here, maybe some friend begins to notice it. So friends become our doctor. And the friend says, Martha, when did you last have a physical checkup? Well, what are you asking that for? Well, the girls were talking the other day, and we feel that you haven't been looking well for the last several weeks, and we're concerned about you. That really gets to Martha, that her friends have noticed that she knows there's something isn't quite right, but she hasn't wanted to do anything about it, because we all tend to push it off. But the friends noticing it act as an impetus to get something to happen. So friends act as our doctor, and hopefully she gets well again. Now, it's Act 1 that I am most concerned about, because you notice I haven't put any doctors in Act 1, and we'll talk about that more in detail in a few minutes. Generally speaking, it's people helping people, and that's what the first act is all about. And this is the area of preventive medicine over here. Preventive health care should be done out here. Well, naturally, I see the church involved in this all over the place, but not realizing that it is involved. So we have church, or churches here. We have the concept of being accepted, as we talked about the other day. The idea of the acceptance of all people, hopefully, into the church, and to be able to be oneself and to be accepted just as I am. Now, we'll come back to this. Suppose that you or this person doesn't listen to himself or his family or his friends, and he just goes on, and now he gets sicker.
He now is so uncomfortable with his sickness that he decides to go see his doctor. And this is about the time that most family doctors are seen in Act 2. So he goes to his family doctor and he tells her his troubles, and she listens to him and she gives him a complete physical, and then she says, you know, what we really need to talk about, I think, it's your lifestyle. It's your lifestyle that I think is related to your type of illness. And the average patient hates to hear that. And what the average patient does is to try to remember some things to say to the doctor at that point, and they often say something like, well, when I had something like this a couple of years ago, I went to a doctor and he gave me little blue pills. And they really worked. Give me blue pills. Don't tell me I have to change my lifestyle. And today I meet former students around the country, and every now and then one of them will say, remember all that stuff you used to tell us about lifestyle? Boy, you don't know how hard it is to get any patients to change their style of life. They don't want to change. And what can I do sitting in a little examining room, and I've got them for 10 minutes, and I'm preaching at them, and I'm trying to tell them what to do, and I say, well, you ought to put your office in a church so that you can have other people to help you. And of course, they aren't about to do that. But see, I think medical offices generally are in the wrong place. In some medical arts building downtown, or above drugstores in Chicago, or whatever, they're not out related to life. They're not related to other people. The doctor doesn't have a lot of volunteers to help him to work with these people the way we do in our holistic clinics. Each of our clinics has anywhere from 10 to 30 volunteers per week who help in that clinic as volunteers to assist the doctors and the pastors and the nurses with patients who have human problems, which means a large percentage of the patients.